We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we are looking at the Space 1999 episode, Collision Course. Alpha is in the middle of a desperate operation. They're planting nuclear charges around an asteroid on a collision course with the moon. But there is a problem. Alan's Eagle has an engine malfunction. And when he does finally reach the asteroid, the nuclear charge won't disengage. Ignoring the basic laws of physics, Koenig delays the operation schedule not once, not twice, but three times to give Alan a few seconds to get clear. But Koenig already knows he's going to die. Miraculously, or perhaps because of a strange voice in Alan's head, Alan survives and is rescued by Koenig and Paul. Koenig also briefly hears the voice in his head, which leads them to Alan's Eagle. It also leads Koenig to another discovery. Now there's a planet, 34 times the size of the moon, on a collision course. All appears to be lost. But Victor has an idea. Planting a string of nuclear charges between the planet and the moon could create a shockwave that could push the moon out of the planet's path. While Victor prepares Operation Shockwave, telemetry reports indicate the planet could possibly sustain life. Carter, in sickbay, seems a bit delusional, and Helena informs Koenig that despite all the equipment telling her that Alan suffered no radiation exposure, he's clearly suffering from radiation exposure, which means Koenig and Paul are too. Koenig doesn't believe it, and he takes an eagle up to reconnoiter the planet. He encounters an alien ship and is swallowed by it. On board, Ara, Queen of Aetheria, tells Koenig that their worlds have been brought together through timeless destiny, and their worlds must touch for Ara and her people to evolve to the next level of being. The Alphans will be unharmed. Koenig knows no one will believe him, but he buys it hook, line, and sinker anyway. He calls off Operation Shockwave and explains his reasons. Ara asked him to let the worlds collide. The Alphans sedate and confine Koenig and proceed with the plan anyway. Ara awakes him and Alan, and they storm main mission, preventing the detonation. The worlds collide, and Aetheria disappears, and the moon continues on its solitary quest. Next time, have a little more faith in John Koenig. So, Collision Course. Collision Course. Collision Course is considered one of the stronger episodes of Space 1999. Witness the fact that it was one of the three or four first episodes that they played when they took them all wildly out of order and tried to front-load the quote-unquote better episodes.
I didn't see this one.
Really?
No.
Wow. I would say I've probably seen this one more than any other. Maybe more than Dragon's Domain.
I think I might have seen the ending, because as I was watching it, not one bit of it looked the slightest bit familiar until the very end when I saw the moon and Aetheria apparently collide. And then I thought, wait, it seems to remind me of something, but that's it.
I never saw this. I've seen this one more than some others. And I think I probably have like three copies of the Space 1999 book, because I used to like go into Bookman's down in Tucson, and I would find the Space 1999 novelizations, and I could never remember which ones I had, so I kept buying them whenever they'd show up. And so I had multiple copies of the one with Collision Course. I mean, this is just one that is synonymous with the first season of Space 1999 to me. And here's the thing. All those times I've seen it and all those times I've read it and whatnot, I didn't hate it until I listened to it and watched it for review purposes this time.
Uh-huh.
And having now watched it,
with a scrutinizing eye?
Everything I hate about John Koenig and their attitude towards science and logic and computers is in absolute abundance. This is an episode that says faith is more important than anything else.
Yeah, I kind of got that.
Blind faith.
I got that. This really felt like that episode. You know, we've talked about this in past episodes where, and you can phrase it better than I can because you're the one who said it. So I'm going to be paraphrasing this terribly, but it was like, you know, do away with the facts and let's go with the touchy feely emotional. You know, it's important to be the emotional, to be feeling, you know, instead of being analytical kind of thing.
Yeah, this is John Koenig to a T. I mean, was it just last time in Voyager's Return? It's like, yeah, so what if Alpha gets destroyed? I'm going to give this guy another minute of deadly lethal radiation exposure for everyone because, you know, I want him to succeed.
I really want him to succeed, yeah.
Koenig, you're killing everyone on the base for this purpose. And it's what he does it with Alan. I mean, you know, Alan's an important character, and you're not going to let him die. But not only does he delay it to give Alan time to deposit the charge. Now, arguably, without the charge being there, it's not going to succeed, and Alpha could be destroyed. So that one might be worth a gamble, maybe. But when you know you're going to – he knows he's going to sacrifice Alan. I mean, he gives him a little extra time to get away, and even after he gives him a little extra time, then they go 13 seconds past – the little extra time that he gave him, and, you know, he orders him blown up, and he's crying. Koenig is crying. He knows he has just sentenced Alan to certain death.
Yeah.
He knew that 23 seconds earlier, when he gave him the extra 23 seconds. And what he should have done, and this would be a really tough call, he should have detonated the nuclear charge when Alan was able to position it on the asteroid and blow up the Eagle with it.
That would have been my first thought, given the circumstances, what they were.
That's right. And Alan would have done it.
Yeah.
Alan would have
agreed with it. For the sake of Moonbase, for the sake of Alpha, absolutely, he would have done it.
And Koenig, yet again, not only does he refuse to, and here's the thing. Maybe in 1975, the layman audience watching a show like this is too stupid to realize that the reason we're able to launch a space probe like Voyager or Pioneer or any of the Mars probes or any of this, any of the ones that have come since then, the reason we're able to do that and get them to pass within a gnat's ass of where we want them to do at billions of miles, right? Millions, billions of miles, whatever it is out there. The reason we could do that is because physics is a predictable,
it's a predictable,
well understood science.
Yeah, science. Absolutely.
The computers, you put the numbers in,
they're going to spit out accurate.
They're going to spit out what you need. And so we can assume that if Bergman says we need 12 nuclear charges of this size to vaporize an asteroid of the materials that we need and to get us in the way, then he's right. He should be right. Those computer calculations should be right enough to know that it needs to be detonated when it needed to be detonated. And Koenig, you know, nope. Ignore what the machines say. Ignore what your cold and thinking calculations say. I'm going to play this by my gut. He is a terrible commander. He is an appallingly bad commander. He is not gambling on the odds. He's not gambling on anything, really, except blind luck. The difference here is Kirk is gambling on... If he were to gamble in his case, he would gamble on something that had a tangible thing to it. Whether or not it's, I'm gambling on how somebody is going to behave, or I'm going to, again, it's usually gambling on how somebody is going to react to something. But here, he's just saying, you know, dumb luck, Alan ought to be able to get the thing planted and get out of there and survive. And I really... Boy, watching it this one, I was just insane. And the theme comes and goes throughout the episode. So, for example, the bad physics themes go, all sorts of things go. But he come back to the base, they've rescued Alan, they come back to the base, they skip radiation decontamination. Or at least, sort of, they skip radiation decontamination. Because Koenig says, yes, skip it. But Helena holds him in the thing anyway to run the tests on him.
Right.
And she says, yeah, okay, you're clear. And so he comes on out. So if he's clear, he doesn't need decontamination. So it seems to me like they didn't actually bypass correct procedure there. They went ahead and did what they were supposed to do. Now, They've got Alan in sick bay. They've got the monitors on him. They've got the equipment on him. They've got the computers on him. They're all registering no radiation.
Right.
Dr. Russell, the trained professional, looks at the instruments that say no radiation, looks at the computers that say no radiation, and she says, it's got to be radiation. I'm a pro. I know what I'm talking about. I'm a pro.
She does qualify that by saying that, because Koenig asks her, and he says, your test set, and she says, those were only preliminary. You know, the really detailed test that would verify it one way or the other would take several days.
She did say something to that effect, but nonetheless, you know, then what would be the point of even bothering to check?
Why bother doing the preliminary then?
Why bother with the preliminary when he got off the Eagle and said, hold on, let me just check you there. As if that test is completely unreliable, what's the point of doing it? Because we know how radiation works. You put a Geiger counter near it, it goes off.
That shows you've had radiation poisoning. Absolutely.
That's the whole point of radiation, is it's those particles coming off that are striking the mechanism in the Geiger counter. It's either it is either radiating or it is
not. Or it's not.
We had that silly magnetic radiation thing in earlier in Breakaway, and we can come back to that in a little bit. But the point is, you know, if you're saying that Alan is behaving with classic radiation sickness symptoms,
there should be other symptoms, you know, or other indicators, like you said, you know, take a Geiger counter. Don't tell me that on Moonbase Alpha they don't have something as primitive as a Geiger counter to be able to determine if the man has got radiation poisoning or not.
Okay, but now think about this. If there's no trace of radiation, she's making your diagnosis
based on his
symptoms, which could be a whole bunch of other things. I mean, all he is unconscious and he's delusional.
And then she just goes on to say that it's radiation poisoning.
Radiation. It's got to be radiation.
Yeah, that's radiation. I found her statement. I'm a professional about this. You know, I know what I'm talking about to be a little bit more than just arrogant.
And then, so not only is she arrogantly ignoring her own equipment, Koenig turns around and arrogantly ignores her.
I know, arrogance abound, isn't there?
It's like, and who's right? Turns out Koenig's right.
Yeah.
Helen is wrong. It's not radiation sickness. The instruments are right. But Koenig is not, Koenig in this case is relying on the instruments, not Helena. Right. Yet later in the episode, Koenig is the one who is relying, frankly, on a creepy space woman who just says, oh, you've got to let our planets, we're going to move on to the next plane of existence. It's like, yeah, well, that sounds great. Well, you're telling it to me. It's like, did that actually sound great to you, Koenig? I mean, moving on to the next plane of existence in most religions means dying.
Yeah. I'm a little perturbed that Koenig would accept everything that she told him on blind faith.
Yes. You just got to have that gut feeling. He's having that gut feeling. I think I trust her. I trust this woman. She didn't kill me. She saved Alan. And you know, she just wants our moon to collide with her planet.
Yeah,
she couldn't possibly be crazy, could she?
It's so reasonable. It makes perfect sense. I know. The whole bit just it left me asking, what was the whole purpose of this? Seriously, I mean, I'm not talking about the purpose of, you know, what the Queen of Etheria was saying, you know, that we need the moon and blah, blah, blah. Although I question the whole science in that. I mean, that just really seemed like mumbo jumbo. But what was the whole purpose of this story?
Wow.
I mean, were they trying to present this dilemma, moral dilemma kind of thing about the differences between hard science and blind faith? Because if that was the purpose, because as I was watching, I kept thinking, this episode feels like it's supposed to have a moral.
Purpose is the answer to this question. Okay. We go back to Black Sun, and I'm sure at the time we had this discussion at Black Sun, I probably, knowing Collision Course was coming, I think you did.
I think you mentioned
it. Hinted it in here. Alpha has a purpose. Alpha is not an aimless wanderer in space.
Apparently
Alpha
not.
Alpha is doing something. Coming in contact with the Black Sun, having a force out there that's looking out for them, and then coming in contact with this planet, and it's, you know, for countless millennia, we've waited for your thing. It's like, well, that's, you know, ours is just an accident. We wouldn't be here. It's like, oh, how you... What did she say? How you belittle yourselves? For so, such an important race, how you belittle yourself in the scheme of things for something who is yet you are so small yet so important.
Yeah, you know, but I'm not talking about the purpose of Alpha within the canon of this entire series.
No.
I'm talking purely from a story writing purpose or story writing point of view. I kept getting the feeling that because every so often we get episodes that are just meant to be enjoyed. You just watch them, enjoy them, okay, move along. Although I haven't seen many of those in this show. But this one really felt like it was supposed to have a moral.
I mean,
that's the way they wrapped it. It feels like this story is supposed to have a freaking moral.
Purpose is its purpose. It's to tell you that
that's
Alpha
lame.
Has a purpose.
Oh, that is – you know, and but you're right. I that's what I kept coming up to. That's what I kept coming back to. Actually, no. I was coming – I arrived to the conclusion that the moral of this story was supposed to be the argument about science versus faith.
Except for just that one little thing. There's one little thing that – I mean, if this episode irritates me from one end to the other because of this, you got to have faith. Faith – John Koenig has never failed us before. I mean, every time he's ever had a hunch, it's played off. We ought to have faith in John Koenig. I mean, they say that, and of course they betray him right behind his back, but they say it to his face. And throughout this whole episode, they're doing everything anti-science, anti-logic, everything anti-reason that just irritates the heck out of me out of his story. But I could almost accept it if that is meant to be the purpose in the universe that, you know, you have to set it aside and say, Alpha is actually the sperm of the universe reaching out and touching eggs and forming things in a symbolic way. I could accept that, except then you get to the last stinking scene where Helena comes and apologizes to John. And, you know, so that we should have had more faith in you, John. And he turns around and says, no, you were absolutely right. What I was doing was batshit crazy.
Yes, exactly. Now that.
And there goes the moral.
There goes
story.
The moral. Exactly. You're absolutely right. I mean, because now he's yeah. You're absolutely right. And I realized that too as I was watching it, and thought so. Then again, I come back to, I mean, for me, it felt like they were trying to deliver this whole issue about hard science versus blind faith kind of thing, and that could have been an interesting message. But I mean. Ending the very ending of this episode, notwithstanding, the whole manner in which it was being delivered was pathetic. It not a very good execution. There was no room for really good argument. It was just a lot of people screaming at each other and pointing fingers, saying, "No, you're wrong," and that's not how you have an intelligent debate.
And I will just we're not doing this in any particular order here, so I won't say. I thought it was very interesting in the final scenes when the planets are coming together. John loses his faith.
Yeah, he does. He says,
he loses his faith.
I believed you. I thought she was telling the truth. Blah, 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 blah. I'm sorry. I failed you.
Yeah.
So that's
a weird scene, too.
So then that completely takes away the whole faith thing again. I mean, I've seen that concept played out so much better on Star Trek, that argument. In a Deep Space Nine episode, I've seen it played out so much better that had that was infinitely more rewarding in terms of the it didn't answer any questions, but you felt like that there was still a worthwhile argument.
Yeah,
Instead of this, Koenig weenies out twice. The first time is when he thinks, "Oh, I really thought she was telling the truth," and blah 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 blah. I'm so sorry. Let me. Yeah. You know, let me repent. And then at the end, yeah, when he says, oh, no, you know, if I were in your position, I would have done the same thing. Like,
yeah, I would have been upset if you hadn't done that. I mean, it's like, well.
Well, what was the whole purpose of this then again?
Yeah.
I mean, except for the fact that the purpose of this episode is that Moonbase Alpha has a purpose. You know, that is weak. That's not a really good foundation in order to build an episode on. Not like this.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Black Sun did it infinitely better.
Black Sun presented us with a mystery, and they were in a situation where Alpha did everything they possibly could to save themselves, knowing that they probably would not, but their lies were more to keep up the spirits and the hopes of people, and they never gave up
right. Throughout
the course of the episode. And then a benign alien metaphysical life force comes to their rescue and says, hey, there's more to the universe than you think. And, you know, go on about your way. Nice to meet you. And that's okay. But here we have taken a hard line that says for this to come to pass, you've got to accept this on blind faith. And
which, I mean, from the very beginning, the premise is unacceptable.
And apart from the fact that Koenig has shown himself to be completely unfit for command from a logical standpoint repeatedly over and over again, it's just that the man is the luckiest creature in the universe, that every time he does something wrong, he gets lucky and they survive. And which, of course, could be cosmic forces, but but we'll put that one aside for a second. I'm not a person of faith. I haven't got faith. Not that kind of faith. I've never had that kind of faith. I can't not ask the questions. I can't follow the logic. So it's very hard for me to look at a scene where Koenig goes on board that spaceship and he is convinced by this woman to believe in the story. There is nothing that she says to me that I hear that would move me one picometer
Absolutely not.
So it's unrealistic. It seems unrealistic to me, but at the same time, having faith in higher powers seems unrealistic to me, so I'm not the best judge. But it seems way over the line.
I'll give it to you because I am a person of faith, but even I would find that questionable. And granted, the only moment where Koenig questions it during that, he says, "I'm going to need more in order to convince my people." And she says, "Are
you going to get it?"
She's saying, "You're not going to get it." And are you that? Basically, she's accusing him of being a weak commander. Mm-hmm. You know, not being a very strong commander. I mean, if you can't convince your people to do that, and he failed anyway. He didn't convince them anyway.
No, he didn't. And her words are the words of, you know, they might be the words of a prophet. They also might be the words of a crazy person.
Exactly.
You know, she is talking in the metaphor that you might expect the who were the people who killed themselves because they didn't get to go to the
comet people. Them.
You know, that's the kind of speech. It's like, oh, these are going to come together and we'll rise to a new plane of existence, and this has been destined since the dawn of time. It's like, yeah, you know, those are just words. You're just saying words, and there is no reason for me to believe that, and why would you believe it, and et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, it really does bug me. But, you know, we see time and time again, Koenig just is not a man of numbers, and yet he's supposed to be this great scientist. But again, so is Victor, and although Victor takes the side of reason on this one, he's frequently
more the philosopher.
Philosopher type thing. So apparently a great scientist in the Space 1999 realm is one who can rise above science and have faith. So a couple things. Try to pull a few areas that just were kind of weird. After the radiation cloud descends on Alpha, couple things. One is, this is a completely unknown type of radiation and we don't know anything about it. It's like, why would that be a completely unknown type of radiation? I mean, they say that, but the fact is it's their nuclear charges.
Exactly.
How many nuclear charges did they need to have on the moon base? That's just another question I have to ask. But okay, they had at least 12 plus however many they used in shockwave, which seems like an ample supply of nuclear charges to have on your moon base. But yeah, they should understand this radiation. Why would they not? I mean, yes, it's blown up a chunk of rock. So you blow up a chunk of rock with known radiation, with known atomic energy, you should kind of have a good feel for this. But they don't. And that is one of the reasons, of course, you need that to play into Helena's story about, well, this could be a different kind of radiation. It's like, well, we have no evidence it's a different type. There's no reason to make you think there's a different type of radiation, except that the scriptwriter wanted to have an excuse so that everyone wouldn't feel bad when they're looking at Koenig going, yeah, must be radiation sickness.
Well, it sounds like, you know, as you describe it, it sounds like to me that they're really playing this for an audience that is not at all versed in any type of science whatsoever.
Another thing with Koenig in that same scene, or basically in that same scene, you know, he's trying to call Alan. He's desperately calling Alan. He's sitting at his desk. And Martin Landau, I mean, his crying when he gave that order to detonate and kill Alan. I mean, the guy can act. I mean, that was...
Yes, he can.
That was good. But then he comes back and he's in that frantic sort of, I'm not giving up. Alan might still be alive. And we all know Alan has to be dead. And Bergman tries to come to him and you know, John, you know, get on with the job. Alan knew the risks, et cetera, et cetera. And he has that little speech. If you think go ahead and tell me I made the wrong decision. Go ahead and tell me I'm wasting my time. But if you're trying to tell me he's not alive out there, I don't want to hear that. Interesting way of phrasing it.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear it. This is intentionally shutting himself off from the probable facts. Again, we're back to Koenig's.
It's all emotion, feely kind of thing.
I don't want to hear it. And
no facts.
Not, you know, fingers in the air, la, 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 la. I don't want to hear it. Alan's not dead.
Yeah.
And of course, he's right. And, you know, come on. Alan should be dead. If it'd been any other Eagle pilot, he would be dead. They kill him all the time, right? If you needed to sacrifice somebody, well, okay, I think that's the point. If the writer had been intending to show that Koenig could make the command decision to kill someone, then he could have used any Eagle pilot. I think Koenig could have shed a tear for any one of the people on Alpha. Didn't have to be Alan or somebody that we, the audience, know. They did it with Alan intentionally twofold. One was to show that Koenig refuses to believe in the death. Because if it had been anybody else, you know, we know that the writers would have just, Koenig would have been upset, but he would have known the guy was dead. But because it's Alan, it's different. And then second, because Alan is in fact survived, basically miraculously.
Yeah.
It's a miracle that he survived.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, Ara never plays that card. I saved Alan for you. She never plays that card.
No, she doesn't. It's almost like she has, I hate to say this, she has faith that Koenig will figure it out.
Well, I mean, they've been studying for millennia, knowing that this day would come. So, yeah. The other thing is, of course, Koenig hears the voice in his head saying what the coordinates are, and he just says, okay, set the course. And Paul goes, well, I haven't even calculated the course yet, Commander. And he says, yeah, I did it. And Paul just, yeah, whatever, and goes on. Koenig never explains it. Koenig never is like, why that course? You'd think Paul, see right there, Paul had faith in Koenig. He's like, yeah, I mean, heck, every time else he pulls something out of his rear end, it must be right. So, hey, why would he pick a random course while I'm the one doing the actual plotting?
Well, he did give a rather weird look, but I think it was all in the result. The fact that, yes, they did track Alan down, that he was like, okay, I'll let this one, you know, hand wave.
Well, I mean, yeah, but he let it go before they went because he did look at him funny, like, well, that's strange, Commander. But he never, and there was never any follow-up on that. He never said, how did you know, Commander? You know, when they find it, wouldn't that be the thing? Wouldn't that be your thought? How did you know he was there? How did you know that course? Nobody asks. The question is left unasked because, of course, that's what you do in faith. You don't ask questions. Or at least in this kind. I had faith in Koenig, but later on I don't have enough faith in him because he's nuts. And I suppose if he'd said, oh, a voice in my head told me to go on that course, Paul. If he'd said that, Paul would have actually more reason to believe Koenig because he was right.
Probably. Possibly.
I heard a voice tell me that course. Now, he might have thought, and you listened? But the fact is that he got it, and then he's like, then if Koenig had said, I heard a voice telling me to go that place, the proof is undeniable that you did find Alan exactly where you thought he was going to be.
So, yeah.
anyway, I was, yeah. Let's see. What else?
I don't really have much else on this episode because okay, let me bring this up. And I'm only bringing this up because you mentioned something about this last week. Wasn't this – one of the things that's made Space 1999 really good has been the visual aspect of it, especially like camera angles, you know, to really heighten tension, to help drive the story, things like that. You know, this episode, was there supposed to be anything like that? Because I found this one to be visually flat.
Okay, so interesting that you should say that. I do have that in my notes here. My recollection, I have recollections from various episodes of Space 1999. So Force of Life, I have the recollections of the characters falling, the camera spinning round and round. From Matter of Life and Death, I have recollections of the dark and light scenes where they're interrogating him in the rooms, and there are pieces throughout the episodes where I remember the cinematography, something unique about the cinematography, right? And so far, whenever we've hit those episodes where I have a distinct recollection, the episode as a whole has been adventurous. Let's say, in the direction or in the camera work. I remember a sequence from this episode that to this day, even watching it this time, to me, is a fascinating question that's not answered. And that was the piece that, to my mind, said, well, this must be another one of those episodes. But as I was watching through the episode, I was struck by how relatively pedestrian the direction was throughout most of the episode. Now, I'll say this. The worst episode of Season 1 Space 1999 is, you know, vastly superior to 95 to 98% of all television cinematography. It is gorgeous. It may be uninspired directing, but, I mean, it is always beautiful. It is just a beautiful program. But, yes, there was... The anticipated directorial flair was not there in this episode, except the scene where Alan and Koenig meet up after they've both been captured. Did you notice?
It didn't impact me.
It didn't impact you.
No.
Well, here's what happens. The two come up, and I may get the order wrong, but the net effect is the same. We get a shot of Koenig coming down the hallway. We get a shot of Alan coming down the hallway the other way. We cut to a shot of, let's say, Alan. No, we cut to a shot of Koenig, and we hear Alan say, "Where is Ara?" We immediately cut to a picture of Alan, and we hear Koenig respond.
Oh, yeah.
We're not seeing them speak. We are looking at the opposite person. And they have applied just the slightest little bit of echo to their voice. And because you never see their mouths move, are they thinking at each other?
I just took it to be some form of telepathy that Aaron was making possible for them.
That would have been absolutely proven if they had shown Koenig not moving his mouth and hearing his voice. But because they swapped them, you can't tell for sure. They could just be talking to each other. And I so distinctly remember that. The very first time I ever saw that, I thought that is just weird. And of course it's highlighting what you can do with how you present your visuals in a show. I mean, you know, the difference between having a two shot where they're just talking to each other or you would go to a two-shot within close-ups where you bounce back and forth with each of the person talking. But by taking that standard television convention, or movie convention for that matter, and reversing it, it creates a slightly disconcerting effect. And somehow, I just, like the other episodes, I just kind of projected that on to the rest of the episode. But really, it wasn't there. So that is why I mentioned it. I knew that this episode had some touches like that, and yet that was the only one.
I guess I was expecting something more, and it came off underwhelming.
I was expecting something more. I was expecting more things like that, but as I'm watching it, there weren't any. It was all very pedestrian.
Yeah.
And so in that respect, I was disappointed in it. But yes, I was expecting more, and I just got that one little bit, and far more questions than it answered. And it didn't really, I don't know that it did anything.
Not really.
If they were mind talking to each other, what would it mean? Nothing really. So,
no, because there's no payoff to that.
Right.
The only thing that we get is, they understand, they understand that, they have some sort of a common link with Aaron, and that's it. That is it. I mean, there's no other kind of payoff to this, so it inevitably becomes totally inconsequential.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we know Ara can talk to them in their minds, so it would make a certain amount of sense that, well, Ara could be relaying.
Yeah, she's playing some sort of, she's like a conduit, allowing the two of them to speak, since she's touched both of their minds.
Okay. I forgot to mention this. When we were talking about Helena, and she was complaining to John about how this is radiation sickness, obviously, hey, I know my job. I think that's her line. I know my job.
Something like that, yeah.
Right. Really? In every episode we've watched.
Oh, she does not
Helena
know her job.
Helena does not know her job.
Another reason. I'm glad you brought that up. Now that you mention it, that's probably another reason why I found that line to be a little arrogant, because I've not seen evidence of that.
I can't even write what I wrote after it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. On my notes, I can't say it on the podcast.
It will give the explicit tag.
Mild swear word here and there, but this one might be over the line. It was exactly how I typed it out. It's like, I know my job.
Yeah, it was pretty beyond the pale, really, for her to say that, given everything that we've seen so far. I mean, I would have seen Dr. Matthias, is that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would have taken that a little bit better. I would have accepted it from him, to be honest. If he had said it, and if he had said it to her, I would have applauded it.
Mm-hmm.
But for Helena to say it came off really inappropriate and rather insulting, because she has shown no evidence of that really up to this point. I mean, we've heard credentials being rattled out in Breakaway for a little bit, but that's it. Since then, we've seen no evidence that she really knows what she's talking about.
Hmm. Here's one that when I went to look on the internet to try to do a little research, what I found was such an amazing disparity of answers, some of which seemingly from authoritative people, that I was surprised. And that is, if you set off a bunch of nuclear charges between two objects, is there a shockwave?
Well, considering that there's no atmosphere.
Right. So you cannot have a shockwave of a compression wave.
No, there's no compression
air.
Wave. No, there. No, because I mean, it's not like. Say for example, I want to bring in this up because I saw this very recently in a Babylon 5 documentary, where Straczynski says that, okay, how do you explain sounds in space? Well, he spoke to somebody at JPL and said, well, the atmosphere, there is a contained atmosphere inside the spaceship or the fighter, and when it explodes, there is a compression wave. It's small, but it's there, and it resonates against, other ships, so they hear something, they feel something. Okay, bit of a stretch, but there is some science to it. But in this case, it's a void.
Well, okay, so, and like I said, surprisingly amount of back and forth on that. Space is not a void.
Well, there are random hydrogen atoms that are floating about.
There are
but atoms, is that there? Enough to create a compression wave?
There's the radiation, the particles from the explosives themselves. There is force that can be imparted from the particles, the radioactive particles. It would nowhere near.
It wouldn't be enough. Big.
Well, that's a question.
I mean, I can't imagine that it would. I mean, okay, so they've got what was it 20?
I don't know.
I can't remember how many they strung up. I think it was 20. It was at least 12.
12 was the asteroid.
Okay, 12, yeah, but I think it was 20, 20, you know, something like that, in order to effectively shift the direction of alpha. I can't see that. I mean, it sounds good to the uneducated, but really, if you start, to me, I just don't think that there's enough of a compression wave there to actually alter the orbit or the direction. Then we had the magnetic radiation that blew the moon out of its orbit.
Mm-hmm. So they're playing fast and loose, but I'm just picking on it because I don't think it's accurate. I don't think you get enough force out of it. But more than that, let's just say that you could. Let's say you could get a little bit of force out of it, an amount that we can measure the density of the particles in space. We can calculate the particles that are in the bombs. We can calculate how much force you would get out of the photons and the electrons being blown apart and the radiation, whatever you're going to get out of this thing, which Victor should be able to do with the computer, and measure that up against the speed and trajectory and the mass of the moon, and come up with a calculation. Well, for starters, let's say you could do it. The further away from the planet you are when you set off the explosion, the more likely you are to be able to deflect yourself, if that makes sense. In other words, if you could get 1/10 of a degree of deflection a billion miles out, as opposed to 1/10 of a degree of deflection 100 miles out.
Oh, no, no, you're absolutely right. That is absolutely correct. Yes.
And yet, apparently, Operation Shockwave, the charges had to be detonated within seconds of them actually colliding, because
it would never happen. And something that size,
that's the scene we see at the end,
right?
Right, they're ready to push the button at exactly the moment. Koenig manages to delay them for about
a
minute.
And Victor says it's too late.
That's when they cutch.
Victor says it's too late. It was too late a long time ago.
Uh huh. It was not like those are so close at that point. You wonder where the nuclear charges were.
Yeah.
like you're practically so close to the planet now that, never mind. It's going to be. Other questions that I thought were really interesting is they're thinking that maybe they could go to the far side of the planet, because it's not terribly hospitable, but it seems to be survivable. So if they evacuated to the far side of this planet and the planet is hit by the moon, now the moon is 1/34 the size of the planet, could the planet survive? Koenig asks that question of Bergman. And what is Bergman's answer? Oh, no, wait. No, so did he? I forgot which question it was. It was either can the planet survive, or was it can you make enough force to move them apart? And Bergman's answer is, well, John, how long is a piece of string? What does that mean?
What is that supposed to mean?
It's like, you got a string. You don't know how long it is. Measure it. We could measure it, Victor. We have rulers. Measure the string, ruler. Victor, tell us whether or not how long that piece of string is. Measure the physics, man. Do this. So again, it was that kind of I'm really annoyed at their cavalier disregard of everything. It's like science is just a guessing game. Let's teach your kids that. Again, I'm amazed that anybody could go on after watching Space 19, and I did. And, it was like, wow, science fiction is cool. It's like, this is totally an anti-science fiction.
Well, keep in mind, and I've said this many times before, the reason we ate this stuff up when it first came out is because we had nothing else.
Do you know there's like a ton of science fiction shows on TV right now, and yet most of them do not grab my attention?
Well, not now today, no. The stuff that's out there now, because there's a great variety of content to choose from, so I don't feel necessarily starved.
If they put a Space 1999 remake on or a show that had even vaguely the same premise of a space opera, I would be there in a heartbeat. I would. It's just that the type of science fiction they tell now is...
And there's a lot of science fiction that's out there now, I mean, even now, that I don't view very highly because I just don't like the overall tone of the show or the really cavalier...
It's all very nihilistic.
Yeah. You know, it's just not something that really appeals to me. I'm not really getting that good science-y space opera kind of thing that I desperately like. You know, we get them in some movies that are coming out, you know, like with The Martian or with Interstellar, things like that. So there is...
I love The Martian.
So there's a lot of stuff that's still being produced for... fans like us, so we are in a position now where we don't have to say, oh my god, I will watch Star Lost because I don't have anything else to watch.
If they came out with something with that premise right now, I'd go, yep, I'd watch that. I would put that one on. The only show that I think that's on right now and that I don't watch and that I would if it weren't for the vagaries of being a cord cutter. As a cord cutter, I don't have any kind of broadcast television. Therefore, I don't have cable channels. Therefore, I can't access streaming video from certain channels. I would probably watch at least once The Expanse.
I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't either, and I have a feeling I can't watch it with my family based on what I've heard about it, but it sounds like...
I've heard good things, but, you know...
Something I'd want to watch.
I heard good things about Dark Matter, and I watched that and didn't care for it. I heard good... In fact, I was actually disappointed with Dark Matter. So, you know, and we're about to have a sidecar episode here now. but I guess the point still comes back to, at least now we've got a plethora of bad sci-fi. Okay. That's one thing. But back when
different
Space,
kind of bad.
Yeah, different kind of bad. But when Space 1999 came out, we didn't have really any sci-fi except for the reruns of Star Trek they were getting. And for those poor, you know, those lucky sods who were able to get Doctor Who, and that's hardly sci-fi in of itself.
I was saying, 75, boy, you're really pushing it in this country for Doctor Who.
Yeah, well, there were a couple of rare places that were picking it up. But it, like I said, it was very far and few between. So for the majority of people that like science fiction, when Space 99 came out, you know what? We watched it because we had nothing else to go to. I loved it. Now, I'm not saying that, and I don't believe that the, you know, Jerry and anybody else that worked on the show saw that as, oh, guess what, guys? You know, these people, they don't have any sci-fi. We can deliver them crap and they will watch. I don't think that that's what they were thinking.
No. They have put way, way too much into the design and they're clearly trying to be profound. Okay. They are clearly trying to be profound here. They are doing it in the most unprofound fashion. They're clearly trying to, and I've heard this in many interviews with Barbara Bain and Martin Landau and Jerry Anderson from the time. They were trying to rival Star Trek for a show that was thought-provoking and deep. This was not meant to be just eye candy, like Buck Rogers in the 25th century. This was meant to be a profound show about the place of man in the universe, but they have taken this position that is weird, is the best way I can go about it. It's that their idea of profound is Victor is a philosopher, not a scientist.
Yeah.
Right? That's what they've taken as profound. Faith is more important. You gotta feel more than you gotta think. That's what they've taken out of this. They're trying to say that science and logic and numbers dehumanize us. They take away what is human in a person. And so they've gone the opposite way to try to make these people more human. And they failed. They've
failed
made
miserably.
These people more they've made these people more illogical and more, you know, just dead lucky that they survive here. They don't deserve to survive, particularly with Koenig in command. They just don't deserve to survive, and yet they do regularly. And the funny thing is that you could argue that Star Trek does kind of take, particularly later Star Trek, but earlier Star Trek still had a sort of technology is cool, technology is going to help solve our problems. And yet their basic fundamental message is one of humanism.
Yes. They were able to strike a really great balance between the two. And this is something that Space 99 is failing at. Now, I get the idea, the original concept possibly, that the big thing that we're going to be seeing in this series is, you know, it's not so much about space exploration like we were seeing with Star Trek. It was more about how the universe is just such an unbelievably bizarre place. It is terribly mysterious. It's filled with a lot of unanswered questions. Okay, that in of itself is okay if you approach these things from an analytical point of view. And now I have to kind of wonder, based on just what we're discussing here, if this really became more about speaking more to the good, touchy-feely, faith-filled kind of story, I mean, if that became the focus in the story writing, does that set up the possibility for the big wondrous element of each episode to suddenly fall flat?
I think the message does fall flat a lot of times. I think a lot of the episodes in Space 1999 that we've seen so far, where you're supposed to be presented with a big wondrous mystery of space, makes more sense if you try to project on it that Alpha is some sort of cosmic catalyst, that it is not passing these planets by mistake. Everything that happens to it is part of a destiny, of a greater plan throughout space. And so the mystery isn't one of bad storytelling, which is what we generally get. You just like, well, stuff happened, and we don't know why, and we don't know where it's going to go from there, and so we've left, and that's the mystery of a bad story writer, because the mystery is, what was he thinking? But if you try to project upon that and say, space God works in mysterious ways, and we're trying to fathom the unfathomable hand of space God, then you could kind of go, okay, yeah, I mean, yep, space God works in mysterious ways, so it's a parable or something. And it misses at that level too. But you get an episode like this every once in a while where space God's hand rises up a little more obviously by name, if you will. We don't call it that, but you know, that sort of, you're here for a reason, and you don't understand that reason because you can't. You're just primitive little ants. But on the other episodes, you could kind of try and behind some of the episodes, you could try to rewrite that piece of headcanon into it, and maybe you could see the writer's hand trying to do that. But I'm not sure. I think it's just. Yeah. It's funny. I one thought that crossed my mind when we were talking about the humanism in Star Trek, and I'm not really a humanist either, but I'm far more conversant in it because I have quite a lot of humanist friends. I don't know if faith is the right word, but I mean, the value there is the intrinsic value of the human. All people have an intrinsic value. That's one of the core tenets of humanism, as I understand it. And you could maybe say that's faith in humanity? I'm stretching it there. I'm not trying to defend that position, but in other words, it's as close to faith as you're going to get there, is that you believe that people have value, that people have something to contribute to the greater whole, the edict or the whatever. Right, so that there is that sort of, that's what you value, is the humanity. You could almost sort of say that's like if somebody who didn't understand it at all was trying to write John Koenig. That's what they're doing here. It's like I have faith in you as a human being, Queller. I have faith in you as a human being, Alan. You're going to survive. You're going to save the day. And it's, you know, humans are more important than computers. Humans are more important than the sciences. And it's almost like somebody who just saw the word humanism tried to say, well, what would that be? I think that means that he believes people are going to pull through and they're going to always survive with the luck. And I don't think that they're presenting any kind of coherent philosophical point whatsoever.
No, well, they're clearly not. And you make that's an interesting point. I had not considered it, but I think it makes a lot of sense that, yeah, someone who doesn't understand humanism in the first place is now trying to write a humanist character.
Yeah, they've taken the word human and they thought, oh, yeah, okay, I get it.
It must mean this.
Yeah.
And it doesn't.
Yeah, it's like they did not obviously look it up on Wikipedia, which, you know, I should have done too. But anyway, so is Ara a spider?
Are you referring to
her? Is she a spider woman?
Like a Black Widow or something?
Like eight legs. Because now there is the scene where Alan gets up in the sick bay and he approaches her and we see them from the waist up. And when he reaches and grabs her cloak, it turns out to be Helena and it's all in his mind, right?
Oh, yeah.
But when Koenig goes to the ship, it's all filled with cobwebs.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make a whole lot of sense anyway.
It's like no one has been there to clean things up for a long time.
But Ara is sitting on a throne-ish thing, and her clothes or something spill off of it as if you can't see her body and legs. It's as if they have set her down inside of a stool with a hole cut out in the middle so that she's standing, but she looks like she's sitting. And then they have placed all the fabric in kind of folds, big puffy folds that come over the side. So it gives the illusion of her and then legs spread around. And obviously you don't get that from the scene in sickbay. And she doesn't move any of those legs. And indeed, when she disappears, the legs are still there. But she is sitting in the middle of a bunch of spider webs, wearing all black, with that sort of thing. And it is an image I don't know that I ever picked up before. But when watching it this time, I'm like, she looks like a spider sat in the middle of a web in this.
I suppose it never crossed my mind. I just figured that she was living in a society where they weren't bothering to clean up after themselves because they're getting ready to advance to the next plane. So the physicality no longer the physical existence no longer mattered.
All right. One last question then. Would Koenig have shot Helena when she was going for the button?
If he had that gun set on stun, yes.
And that's the next question. Why did he hesitate? So they have stun guns. He's carrying a stun gun. It clearly has a switch to set it on stun. I cannot imagine for a second that Koenig took that gun off a security guard. And A, if the security guard's gun wasn't already set to stun, guarding the commander and the moon base, for starters. In fact, I would say, by and large, that Moonbase Alpha weapons probably should be almost always locked on stun.
They should be.
Until, you know, Koenig gives the orders like, heat them up, boys.
Yeah.
Put them on kill. We got an alien on the base.
Well, that's how it is on Star Trek. I mean, let's be real. I mean, the phasers are always set on stun.
So Helena is going for the switch because you know something, John, you're not going to shoot me. It's like, it's a stun gun, Helena.
I'm going to shoot you because I know you'll wake up.
That's right. I know this is not going to kill you. So it does take some of the dramatic. The fact that that's a stun gun, or it should be a stun gun, takes some of the dramatic tension out of that scene, or it should take some of the dramatic tension out of that scene. And yet they play it as if, I'll kill you, Helena. I'll kill you dead. And he doesn't say that, but the way he's like, don't make me do this. Don't make me do this. And she's like, I don't think you're going to shoot me, John. I don't think you're going to shoot me, John. It's like, if I knew somebody was pointing a stun gun at me, and didn't want me to do something, I wouldn't do it.
I would be...
Because they're going to shoot me.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no... I mean, unless...
A non-lethal weapon?
Yeah, there's really...
Heck, if he had a taser, he'd shoot me.
Right.
I mean, believe it.
The odds are of them being any long-lasting repercussions are pretty small. So, yeah, that would increase the odds.
Because Dr. Mathias would be the one treating her.
Yeah, really. Because
now, if he shot Mathias, I don't think the guy would survive.
No. But, yeah, if he shot Helena, then Mathias obviously would revive her because he does know his job.
And Paul pulls her away. Like, he grabs her and is like, you know... No, Helena, don't do it. He's going to shoot you. And then Paul looks like he's going to go for it. So that's self-sacrificing Paul. I'll save Helena, but now I'm going to risk my life with the guy with the stun gun. Mm. It's just... Yeah, well.
Yeah.
All around.
It's just a lot of failure on this episode. It's pretty epic in its failure.
But yes, they had taken... You know, they took the series, and when they at least put them out in the United States, they swapped their order around a lot. And this one, I think, went out third.
You know, and like I said, I know that I watched at least a dozen or so episodes regularly because two of my best friends who were watching it as well, I mean, you know, they were in a situation where they could easily watch it without any, you know, their parents were encouraging, you know, it was all great. And I wanted to be in on the conversation. So I made a deliberate effort to watch them. And I don't recall this one.
Well, clearly somebody thought it was a good one. I don't know why, but clearly somebody thought it was a good one. Anyway, I think we beat this one.
Oh.
Beat this one to death.
Yeah, clearly.
I'm bummed. I really am bummed. I mean, some of the episodes of Space 1990 have been generally dreadful, and you know, some of them have been dreadful but entertaining. This one really disappointed me on this field.
Yeah, it's a disappointing episode.
It falls flat.
It falls flat.
Is it because I've grown a lot since I saw it? All those years ago when I first watched it, and is it the sophistication of my, well, boy, I hate to use the word sophistication. It's like Helena being arrogant there.
Yeah.
Is it the sophistication of my philosophical outlook on life at age 51, as opposed to my philosophical outlook on life at age 11?
I don't think it's that. I think you have far more discriminating tastes now.
I certainly did not pick up the themes. Or if I did pick up the
themes... Well, I didn't pick up the themes either.
I probably would have agreed with them because, gosh darn, Space 1999 said so.
You know, we've had past Space 99 episodes that have had themes on them. Episodes that I did watch when they originally aired. And I did not pick up on the themes then. I was young enough to where I just... I mean, unless they were beating me over the head with it, like sometimes they do with Star Trek. But in Space 1999, those themes can be a bit ambiguous. So unless you're looking for them, they can slip right by you, especially to, you know, the mind of a 12-year-old. So when I watched it, it just kind of went right by me, you know, many times in past shows. So if with themes in other episodes, you know, I missed them then. I caught them now because my mind is a little bit more... how can I put that without really knocking myself down? I hate to use the word sophisticated again because that does come off as really arrogant. But I do have a more discriminating mind now. I can better scrutinize and analyze things than I could at the age of 12. So it allows me to be able to understand and look at subtext where I couldn't do that at a younger age. So in my case, an episode that I might have thought was pretty strong, you know, and that happened a lot with, you know, like Star Lost and stuff like that. You know, I thought, oh God, this looks really great. You know, I can't wait to watch it. And like, oh wow, I wish I had never seen this and kept with my 12-year-old memories because when I was 12-year-old, because these episodes suck. They didn't suck when I was 12, but boy, they suck badly when I'm in my 50s.
I wonder how they do if you were in your college age. You know, there's a certain phase people go through where things are a lot more profound. Your mind has developed to the point where you're having your own thoughts and you're seeing the world in new and different ways. When you move out and you go to college and you break away from that small isolated atomic family thing that you were with and move into this bigger world, and you know, you see it time and time again, and even, you know, it was funny, my daughter went to this thing at ASU, a summer camp, trying to prompt them to go to that university in 4 years, hence time. And there were quite a lot of counselors there who were college students, and they're all very advanced students because they're in this advanced academic program. And yet listening to them talk casually on the side, it was like, wow, I remember that. I remember that sort of...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The way that you just have to babble on, like we do on this podcast, but the way you have to babble on to other people about these ideas and new concepts that you've got, and this, you know, I heard this in this class, and I mean, it's the implications, like, and you just, your mind is just taking it in, and it's expounding upon it, and enthusing on about it, and I'm just wondering if Space 1999 was targeted for that demographic right there. It's like,
ew, that's an interesting
thought. I'm not even making a commentary about them being drug users at college. I'm just saying, you know, this has that kind of faux pretentious profundity to it. Profundity? I didn't think profoundness. Let's go with profoundness. To it that, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, next time, when we get around to doing Space 1999, I believe it is Death's Other Dominion.
Does not ring a bell.
Death's Other Dominion, not the spoilers, but Brian Blessed.
Oh, really?
This is his first appearance in the series. So, Ben, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
And listeners, I do hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Please consider becoming our sponsor at patreon.com/fusionpatrol. We'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes. Stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Search for us on Facebook under Fusion Patrol. Check out our Twitter handle at Fusion Patrol. Or just send us an email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Please come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.